Welcome to Lincoln, Lincoln, the podcast on 13th and Lincoln. Talk about things at 23rd and Lincoln. Joined today with my co-host Ryan Haney. I'm Curtis Shelton, and we have our guest today in the intro, Brian. Excuse me, Fitzpatrick. I just met you, but I realized that I forgot your last name. But
you got
Brian
it.
Fitzpatrick. Yeah, Ryan, I'll let you introduce our guest. Since
yeah, no, thanks. I appreciate that. So Professor Fitzpatrick got put on my radar really just a few months ago. I came across a paper that he had written on judicial selection and the politics of judicial selection that was published in the Oklahoma City University Law Review. And some of the citations were to some previous papers that he had published. And so I was like, who is this guy? Why have I never heard of him? And can we get him out to Oklahoma City? So Brian, I'm probably not going to go over all of your resume because it's crazy impressive. But just so people kind of understand a little bit about who you are, you got a bachelor's in chemical engineering from Notre Dame.
That's correct.
Then went on to Harvard Law School, graduated first in your class there, was a clerk on the Ninth Circuit, and then on the United States Supreme Court for one of my heroes, Justice Antonin Scalia, and then did some private practice for Sidley Austin in Washington, D.C. Then you were at NYU. Is that right? NYU?
Yeah, I was a fellow at NYU, a law and economics fellow there.
Okay. And then since 2007, you've been teaching law at Vanderbilt Law School.
In Nashville, Tennessee. That's correct. Happy to be here.
And importantly, so for those who don't know, I think Curtis and I have talked about it on the podcast a little bit. Think tanks like OCPA exist all over the country. The one in Tennessee is called the Beacon Center, and Professor Fitzpatrick sits on the board of the Beacon Center of Tennessee. So you're a regular FedSoc speaker, great conservative law professor. We need 1,000 more just like you.
10,000 more. Yeah. We're really outnumbered.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. There are few and far between. Well, hey, thank you and welcome to the podcast.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
So for those who don't know, one of the reasons I asked Professor Fitzpatrick to come out was so that we could talk to some lawmakers about judicial reform. Curtis and I have talked about the need to repeal the Judicial Nominating Commission, to replace it, preferably with something akin to the U.S. Constitution's model of appointing judges and justices, which, you know, our listeners know because they watch Schoolhouse Rock as kids, that the chief executive goes out and appoints people, and then they are subject to confirmation in Washington by the Senate. And one of the reasons I wanted Brian to come out was because Tennessee is, to my knowledge, the only state that has ever adopted a Judicial Nominating Commission selection method and then moved back, or I guess back is not the right word. Did you have elections?
Yeah, before we went to the merit system,
right? As did Oklahoma. So you're not going back, but you're the only state that adopted the quote unquote merit system, because I don't want to give credence to that.
Fair enough.
But the quote unquote merit system, and then moved to what we're trying to adopt, which is the governor can appoint subject to a joint House and Senate confirmation process. And for those who have been following along with OCPA and SJR 40 or 34, rather, you probably know that it was introduced in the Senate as Senate confirmation, but the House quickly amended that. They didn't want to be left out of the process. Is it something I'm wild about? No. But is it something I take a bullet for? Also no. And so the idea was, let's bring out Brian and maybe he can talk to some of these senators, let them know how the process has worked in Tennessee, and hopefully convince them that the details are not worth quibbling over. You want to talk a little bit about when that happened, how the process worked in Tennessee and kind of how things have developed since then?
Sure. You know, our process in Tennessee to change the Constitution is much longer than your process. It has to go to two different legislatures, and then it has to go to a vote by the people. So it was a multi-year process.
Oh, wow.
But we made this change almost a decade ago now in Tennessee, and we basically did exactly what you're trying to do in Oklahoma, and I think it's worked out extremely well in Tennessee. I mean, I think you can go to any corner of our state and ask folks about our appellate judges, and I think they will say they are the best they've ever been. We have a former law clerk to Samuel Alito on our Tennessee Supreme Court now, Sarah Campbell. She's a superstar.
That's big time.
A superstar. And I don't think there's any chance we would ever have anyone like that had we kept our, you know, bar control judicial nominating commission around. So I think it's a vast improvement over what we had before. And, you know, it's just something, you know, people get tied up in the politics, and there are political implications to your method of selection, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise. But for us in Tennessee, it's just a matter of principle. Right. And the principle is, should one special interest group, the legal profession, get a much bigger say than everybody else over one third of our government? And we just couldn't understand what principle there was that would allow for that. And so we changed it.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's great to hear that how well it's worked out. That you, it sounds like you got some real superstars on your appellate courts now. And obviously, it doesn't change overnight. It takes time because these people filter out. You know, we're recording this on a Tuesday afternoon. This morning, right before lunch, the House put SJR 34 to a vote. And so most people, you know, if you're listening to our podcast, you probably follow OCPA's content. You know that this is something we've been tracking and advocating for. And so you probably know that it went down. I forget exactly what the vote count was, but it was something like 36 to 60. It was not good. Somewhere around 45 Republicans, at least, you know, that's what they've registered and ran as, joined all the Democrats to vote against SJR 34. It's unclear to me why Republicans would sort of join in, you know, it's sort of like the opposition is bipartisan, but it's totally partisan on the Democrat side. You know, we know who was coming out against it yesterday. The Oklahoma Bar Association was out, I would say in force, but there wasn't a ton of them lobbying against the bill. Judges have lobbied against the bill in Tennessee. I'm going to assume that it was the same kind of opposition. But you know, what kind of opposition did you get? I know you said it was a multi-year process to even get it on the ballot. But how long had y'all been working on it prior to those 2 years? Tell us a little about the opposition and how you guys overcame that.
So, the Bar Association in Tennessee, just like your Bar Association here, was adamantly against any change, as well as they should. Let's be honest. They have a lot of power in the current system.
Yeah, we can't fault them for it.
No one wants to give up power. So I don't begrudge the Bar Association for looking out for their own self-interest. So, of course, they're going to oppose it. We had been working on it in Tennessee for a long time because there was a little quirk in Tennessee that always left a bad taste in people's mouth about our system. And the little quirk was, unlike you guys who have your commission system in your constitution, we never put the commission system in our constitution. We had a constitution from 1870, if I remember correctly, that said all the judges shall be elected. Mm. And that got corrupted over the years into this commission system, just like yours. And it was upheld by the Tennessee Supreme Court in the 70s that the back end, the retention referendum, I like to call it a referendum to make it clear it's not an election.
Yeah, that's right.
The Tennessee Supreme Court said that's close enough to an election to count. And that was what allowed them to put in the commission system. And you know, frankly, no one really ever accepted that fully because everyone knew it was a subterfuge of the Constitution. Totally inconsistent with the original understanding of the Constitution. So there was always grumbling, frankly, about our system. And what happened in Tennessee was there was enough support to go back to what the Constitution said, elections, that it frankly scared the business community into coming around and supporting the federal method as kind of the lesser of two evils. The business community had frankly been on board with the bar, with the commission system. But when it became clear that elections could be coming back, the business community said, you know what? We'll give this federal method a try. And I have to tell you, I think the business community is extremely happy in Tennessee. We have very neutral judges that are not activists. They're not trying to twist things like that Tennessee Supreme Court did by deciding a retention referendum was equal to an election of judges. And so I think the business community is very, very happy. And I think, frankly, even the bar is happy. They have very smart judges on the courts. And I think that they would say things have not turned out as badly as they thought they might.
That has sort of been our – people have to sort of slowly come around to – I mean, you and I were talking right now. Tennessee is trying – or I should say the Beacon Center and your coalition partners in Tennessee are trying really hard for universal school choice. And it sounds like that may not have gone well today if what Tom Newell was telling me is correct. But yeah, I mean, we have it here, and people are – it's going to take a while. But eventually people are going to have to recognize this didn't close down our public schools. This wasn't sort of the – this wasn't an effort of privatization of everything like we thought it was going to be. And so, yeah, that's good to hear that it's basically the same. I want to switch gears a little bit to talk about your scholarship on judicial selection, because I think the Federalist Society page basically notes your areas of scholarship and your areas of expertise as like class actions, constitutional law, and judicial selection, and maybe federal courts, I think, was one of the other things. Yeah. But obviously, we want to talk about judicial selection. Like I said, it was one of your papers that sort of put you on my radar. And I believe that paper in the OCU Journal was essentially just kind of like a speech that you gave that then we kind of typed up and put some footnotes in it, and it got published that way. But you've been thinking about researching and publishing on this issue, I think, for at least 12 years, I think, or maybe even earlier than that. I think the first paper that I saw in the Missouri Law Review,
yeah,
was that 2012 or 2009?
I don't remember. 2009. Let's say 2009. 15 years.
I probably have it somewhere here on my desk.
That's an even number.
Yeah, it looks like I was 2009. Yeah, in the Missouri Law Review. So, I mean, I think that was your first paper.
That was my first paper
on judicial selection. Yeah. So what are some of the things that you find interesting from your research and publications on judicial selection as they exist in the various states? Because there's no clear majority. No single method dominates the states.
That's correct. You know, in the early days when this country was founded, pretty much all the states, or at least the vast majority of the states, used the same method as the federal government, where the executive nominated, and then there was confirmation by the legislature or some other body like a legislative body. And some states still have that today. You know, that's the system you're basically trying to move to here in Oklahoma. It's what we have now in Tennessee. And there are a number of states that still have that method today. But there was a lot of experimentation in the states over the years. And so the first move was really to get rid of life tenure. You know, federal judges have life tenure. The early states had that as well. They got rid of that. And then the second move was to go to partisan elections. And so a lot of states before the Civil War.
Like the Jacksonian era.
Democracy, democracy, democracy.
Right. People and should be voting
everything
week.
For you know, dog catcher. We should have an election. And so a lot of states changed. And by the Civil War, you know, the majority of states were electing all of their judges. And the next big move was during the Progressive Era, where politics was kind of a bad word. And they wanted to turn over government to experts as much as possible.
Sounds like a great idea. What could possibly go wrong?
The first thing they did in the Progressive Era was to move to nonpartisan elections. They said, let's keep the elections, but let's get rid of the parties, and maybe that will make things better. And that is still a popular method in a number of states, a nonpartisan election. So you don't have any party identification on the ballot. So you're not sure who's who. And we can talk more about that, but I think that's a really bad method. And the second thing the progressives did was what they like to call merit selection, what I like to call the commission method. You may have your own preferred.
I call term. It lawyer selection.
Lawyer selection is another good word. And that was the theory. The theory was, well, we like experts. We like government by experts. The progressives were creating all these administrative agencies to govern everything. They said, well, who's our expert when it comes to judges? Well, it's the lawyers, it's the legal profession. They know best. Let's turn over our judges. Let's turn over one third of our government. It's one of the three branches of government to the legal profession by creating these little agencies, these little expert commissions that'll be dominated by the bar, by the legal profession, and let them decide who the best people are. And then we'll let the governor pick one of the people that they tell the governor it's okay to pick. And then we'll let the public have a say in these retention referenda. And it's very hard to lose those referenda because you have no opponent. And so that was the system they put
in. And even if you think the person's a bum, sometimes the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. Exactly. You might get someone worse.
It's very, very risky to vote someone out when you don't know who's going to be replacing them. But this commission system became very popular, and it took over a number of states starting in 1940, 1950s, 1960s, into the 1970s. States were adopting this, and then it stopped. People stopped adopting this method, and they've since then been trying to get rid of the method. And a lot of states are looking at getting rid of it, not just here in Oklahoma. I've been to Iowa. They're trying to get rid of it there. Kansas trying to get rid of it. A number of other states have realized that, you know what, this promise that we can take politics out of everything by turning it over to experts, it was really naive. Mm-hmm. Because the experts, of course, have their own political views. And that's what my research has really been trying to show, that what are the consequences of turning over one branch of government to a special interest group? And the consequences are, if that special interest group is not like the rest of us, we're going to have judges that are not like the rest of us. And that's what I've tried to show in my research, is that the legal profession is to the left of the American people, to the left of the people of Tennessee, to the left of the people in Oklahoma. There's tons of data now that shows that lawyers are more liberal than the rest of us. So if you turn over one branch of our government to lawyers, of course you're going to get judges that are more liberal than the judges that you and I or our elected officials would pick instead. And that's what the data shows. It's all data. You can just look at the numbers.
Yeah, and that was something that I think in reading your work helped illuminate some things for me, in that even if we assume for the sake of argument, which I'm not willing to grant this at all, but if we assume that the people who are on this commission sort of check all of their political ideology at the door, right? Like they do that. I don't believe they do, but let's assume they do. Then simply the fact that they're not considering political ideology means that we will have a judiciary that is representative of the Bar Association when it comes to political ideology. Because if you're totally neutral, you know, then you'll, you know, however it's skewed, that's how the judiciary will be skewed. And so now, obviously, I, like I said at the beginning, I don't think they check ideology at the door. And so in reality, we're probably getting an even bigger skew, because, you know, the pool is already, you know, over here. And now I think the actors are probably pushing it even further that direction.
Yeah, the leaders are just picking from one side of the pool.
Right.
The pool's already skewed, and the leaders want to make sure they get their side nominated. And so, yeah, that's quite possible.
So, I mean, that's right. So, I mean, if you think about in Oklahoma, and I think this is the way in Tennessee too, right? Like our bar associations are not going to score as progressive as the lawyers in New York and California. They just aren't, right? Like there are going to be some, and certainly it'll be a bigger percentage on the right than the California Bar Association, the New York Bar Association. But if the people on these commissions are only picking from one side, then it doesn't really matter that there are some others, or maybe they're picking even from the middle, right? Or maybe they pick one person from the right who's 65 years old and might have 5 to 10 good years on the court, and then they give, you know, two others who they'd really like to see on there, but are younger, and, you know, should they get through, they'll be on there for a much longer period of time.
Outside of political ideology, as the non-lawyer in the room right now, is there also a problem with the idea? I imagine your experience as a practicing lawyer is much more different than mine would be as someone who, if I ever appear before a judge, would only be because of I was either sent there for some criminal accusation or civil accusation.
That tracks.
Right. Yeah. However likely that may be or may not. But I would imagine, is there also an issue with those who are picking the judges have a very different relationship with those judges in terms of how they would be interacting with them versus the vast majority of the rest of the public, regardless of political ideology? Does that also present the problem perhaps?
Well, you know, I think it does in the following way. You know, lawyers are more liberal than the rest of us. And I think that can really affect the kind of judges that they will pick across a number of issues. But there's one issue in particular that I think the lawyers probably care about more than any other, and it's their own self-interest, their own financial self-interest. They want more litigation because that's how they make their money. It doesn't matter if you're a plaintiff's lawyer or a defense lawyer.
That's right.
More litigation is good for your pocketbook. And that's the one way in which I think all the lawyers end up aligned. And that is where I think there's the most concern among people about the type of judges that come out of these lawyer-dominated commissions. Are they going to be in favor of more and more and more litigation because that's more and more and more money for lawyers?
Yes. I was naive enough to think a couple of years ago that we talked about trial lawyers or the plaintiff's bar, thinking that that was who was sort of driving all the opposition. Until I reached out to a friend who sat on the board of one of these like defense counsel trade association groups, you know, and naively was like, hey, would you guys be interested in weighing in on this? Because, you know, I mean, the court struck down all these tort reform measures and that sort of thing. And, you know, that would be good for your clients, you know, these tort reform. But of course, I don't want to say they don't care about their clients, but not as much as they care about their own billables, right? I mean, so it's like, you know, the answer I got was like, well, I've never really seen our job as sort of being about tort reform. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the more tort reform, the less I'm needed. And I'm like, oh gosh. I don't want to sound, because I get it, but I don't want to sound like I'm sort of better than, but when I was doing criminal defense work, I was still all about reforming the criminal justice system because I saw how it could treat people, right? Like I saw how it could just chew people up and spit them back out. And, you know, would an expungement law like the ones that I've worked on in the past, would that have reduced our expungement work? To some degree, yes, it would have. But it would have been better for Oklahomans and better for the clients that, you know, we say we care about. I was naive. It frankly stunned me when that said. But the more I thought about it, the more I was like, well, it just makes sense. But Curtis does bring up an interesting point, and it's another thing you've talked about. There are a lot of things that we can consider when we talk about judicial selection. Ideology is but one thing. It kind of gets talked to. I want to get to why it gets talked about so much in like your work and the work we're doing. And it's because these other issues are kind of a wash, right? But I mean, there's obviously, so there's independence. So judges being able to make decisions not based on, well, like what their representatives do, right? Will I get not elected or exactly. Will I not get reelected if I make this? So we want them to be independent. But we also want some kind of democratic accountability, right? I mean, people keep talking about, with respect to SJR, they're a co-equal branch, which I think is a stupid phrase. Co-equal is redundant, but they are an equal branch, but they are not without their own checks. They are a check on the legislature, but they're not designed to be without their own checks. And there's some other things we can do, but speak a little bit to how we balance independence and democratic accountability.
Sure. You know, the first thing I think to note about independence and accountability is that these are really not so much about selecting judges, but how you retain your judges.
Right.
That's really what we're talking about when we're talking about independence and accountability. Are the judges going to do what they think is right without looking over their shoulder, or are they going to be looking over their shoulder all the time? It's all about retention. It's all about, if they don't have life tenure is the way you max out on independence.
And that's what Hamilton says in Federalist 78.
That's why the federal judges have it. And frankly, it's why I think our federal judges are so outstanding all across this country, is because that is one hell of a job, Burke, is to not be able to be fired. I have some very extraordinary processes. So I think it's great for independence, and it's great, frankly, for getting high quality people. But there, you know, you're right. There's another side to the coin, which is accountability. If you have a job for life, you can do a lot of crazy things, and that may be bad. You know, we've had Supreme Court justices, I will tell you, who were way past their prime and should probably have retired, but there's no way to force them to retire. And then they, you know, do some not so great things on the court. And, you know, there's some famous stories, Thurgood Marshall, William O. Douglas, just being propped up. And their last years of
it's like Weekend at Bernie's
life. Yeah, seriously. And so, listen, there are some downsides to maxing out independence. And so people say we also want some accountability. And so, you know, there's a range of things you can do on the back end, on the retention side, to kind of strike that balance appropriately. And, you know, the system that we're talking about here is retention elections, retention referenda. You know, that is a way to strike some balance. You know, it's hard to lose a retention referendum, so you have quite a bit of independence, but it's not impossible. And so you might have to pay a little bit of attention to how, you know, far out of the mainstream you get. And so it's not a bad way to strike that balance, in my opinion, are these retention referenda. But that's really a back end consideration. On the front end, there's a lot of other things you could look at. Besides just, are your judges going to be skewed outside of the political mainstream of your state? A lot of things that people look at are things like integrity, mm-hmm. and competence. Are we going to get smart judges? Are we going to get honest judges? And, you know, there's been a lot of studies on these different methods in the different states. It's great for social scientists because you've got variation. You can look at whether some judges in the states where they use elections are smarter or less smart than the judges in the other states. And, you know, political scientists, social scientists, we've looked at that question of what method produces the most competent judges in every way we can think of. And really, there's no evidence that one method of selection is better than any other. Even the elections do just as well as the lawyer commissions or the governors. And so that's kind of a wash, as you said. That's a wash. And so what about integrity? Now, this is an area where I think there are some differences. Because in elections, you have to raise money.
Right.
And even if you're not raising money, people are spending money on your behalf through independent expenditures. People don't like that. Mm-hmm. When you survey people about the legitimacy of the courts, when the courts are elected, they tend to rate them lower. When you tell them, you know, these lawyers gave this judge money and now they're appearing before them, they tend to rate that lower.
Yeah.
And so elections kind of fall down on the integrity.
Which, by the way, I mean, I think listeners will know. I mean, that our local district judges are elected. And I've been saying for a while, I'm not saying that it has negatively affected any rulings that we've gotten, but it's really frustrating as OCPA's attorney. When I look at opposing counsel in a case that's been going on now for 4 years, and opposing counsel is on the election committee for our judge in the district court here. Again, I'm not saying that it's affected anything. I think our judge has been great. I don't think she would let that factor in. But golly, if it doesn't look bad, right? I mean, it looks really, really bad. So, yeah. So I think that goes to like legitimacy, right?
That's probably the better word than integrity.
Yes. How does the public view the court and the decisions that it renders? And of course, the federal courts have not been without some of their legitimacy problems. Less so because I think of the court, and more so because of the political process. But that's by design, I think, to some degree, right?
Yeah. No. Absolutely. I mean, when you have life tenure, you're not always going to make decisions that are popular at the moment.
Yeah.
And that can, you know, that is a driver of what people deem legitimate in a court, is whether they agree with the decision.
That's true too. Yeah.
But there are other drivers. And one of their drivers is money. People don't like it when judges sit in cases where people have spent money to help them get elected. They just think it doesn't look good, as you put it. So I think that kind of, you know, brings elections down a little bit compared to some of the others, some of the other methods. And then, you know, when you kind of get to the end of the list, you're kind of left with, I think, basically a tie between these lawyer commissions and the federal method where the governor puts people on. And, you know, the tiebreaker for me is, are we going to end up with judges that are skewed out of the mainstream on their views of the law, their views of policy, because they are being put onto the bench by one special interest group that itself has skewed views? And for me, that's the tiebreaker. That's why I think, as a policy matter, the federal method, you know, those guys 200 some years ago, they were pretty wise.
Yeah. Well, and I think probably put a pin in after this, but one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because I'm hoping you can expand on it a little bit, because you said something in one of your papers that I read it and I thought, well, that kind of makes sense, but I'd like to hear a little bit more. There's a lot of talk about, and I mentioned this a while ago, there's a lot of talk about how the judiciary, the courts, are a check on the political branches. So the political branches overstep, they violate our rights. Courts are supposed to step in, be our the neutral umpire, calling balls and strikes, saying that's unconstitutional, you can't do that. And so there is a sort of counter-majoritarian, the idea that courts maybe ought to be counter-majoritarian. I think some people are really like that idea because they feel like that's where their rights are vindicated. And I certainly understand that. I think in one of your papers, you said something to the extent that, you know, most of what courts are doing is not constitutional law, you know, vindicating people's rights, that sort of thing. Most of what they're doing is statutory interpretation and essentially expounding on the common law.
Yeah.
And that a counter-majoritarian view in those situations is counterproductive and not good. Can you expand a little bit on
that? Sure, absolutely. So you're absolutely right. Most of us think that the point of the Constitution is to tie the hands of democracy. And therefore, it might be good to have judges that are not too beholden to the democracy to uphold those rights. Now, I don't think that necessarily means that we should have judges that are more liberal than the public. That's one way to be counter-majoritarian. We also have judges that are more conservative than the public. That's another way to be counter-majoritarian. So I don't think that really explains why it'd be a good thing to have this bar selection method. But you're absolutely right that is only a small part of what our state courts especially are doing. Federal courts are not supposed to be doing the common law piece.
Right.
But state courts are supposed to be doing the common law piece. Our judges are making law through their common law decisions. It's basically legislative. It wasn't that way at the founding. They thought it came from natural law, but most everyone's a legal positivist now. And we think that the common law is a legislative decision about how the law should be. Our state judges are making common law. They're making legislative decisions through the common law. What is the value of having that decision counter majoritarian? That'd just be frustrating our own policy preferences.
Yeah,
no, same thing with statutory interpretation. You know, why do we want judges that are not interpreting statutes in the way the legislature would want them interpreted? Why do we want them interpreted against the legislature? That's just going to frustrate the legislature from getting their policies.
Right. Yeah. The people elected those lawmakers, they enact the policy. And unless it's blatantly unconstitutional, right, violates the federal or the state constitution, you know,
you should be trying to follow those policy decisions.
Exactly. Yeah, that's not the time to be counter-majoritarian. I wonder if you agree with me on this too, because I waffle on this because I say what I'm about to say, and then I read someone like Randy Barnett, and I'm like, I should rethink everything I think. But I've often thought that the federal government is a government of limited enumerated powers. So our federal courts should be wicked activists against the federal government, right? Like all these, this administrative state, all these administrative agencies, like the federal government should be, or the federal courts should be striking down stuff all the time. Where is that power enumerated in the Constitution? contrary to that, the states have the broad police power, and they're given sort of a lot more rein. It's not a limited enumerated powers. It's like anything that's not prohibited by your own state constitution or the federal constitution, you can do. And so our state courts, in looking at state law, should be very deferential to legislatures. Of course, then I read Randy Barnett, and Randy Barnett says, oh, no, like, what about unenumerated rights, right? Like, I mean, all that sort of stuff. And, yeah, but I'm just curious. I mean, do you agree, generally speaking, that the state courts should be more deferential to state legislatures?
I think it's a state-by-state question. I do think it's going to turn on your state constitution. Because as far as the federal constitution is concerned, the states are reserved all the other powers. But what does your state constitution say about what your legislature can do? I don't know if your state constitution has something like Article 1 of the federal constitution that says the legislature can only do these 13 things, in which case I think a judge has to be on guard.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I think I.
But if your constitution says the legislature can do whatever they want, then
I think it basically says that. I mean, it doesn't say exactly that, but there is a clause that I think basically says that. If Ben were here, he would know exactly what it is because he's written about it. But yeah, I think there actually is a clause that basically says, you know, the legislature is the policymaking body and they can pretty much do with what they want.
At the same time, we also have one of the longest constitutions in the country.
Oh, it's a novel.
It's like we try to tie their hands, but at the same time, give them all sorts of power.
That's true.
A nightmare in some ways. So
interesting. Yeah. When Andy Spiropoulos came on, he basically walked us through his shtick about how I say shtick, not derogatory. I love it. It's about how Oklahoma government is set up to fail. And of course, the Judicial Nominating Commission is a big part of that. So
it's a good note to end on.
Yeah. Well, Brian, thanks so much for joining us. And hopefully we can get this released fairly quickly. So that, you know, hopefully the legislature will take this back up, do the right thing, and let people vote on whether or not they want to keep the JNC or move to something a little more akin to what they know and what they learned about in fifth grade civics, and something that they understand. And hopefully they'll do that.
And don't give up. No matter what happens, don't give up. It took us a long time in Tennessee, and you know, the bar fights very, very hard, but it's an important principle not to turn over 1/3 of your government to a special interest group, and it's worth fighting for.
I love it.